I'm here last year at the seminar, but most of the talk will be focused on the calculation and the consequences of resonant non-Gaussianity that are produced in this model. So I will just review the model just to refresh your memory. So what I'm presenting is based on these two papers, this one that kind of was partially completed here during a workshop last year, and then this new paper that we had in February with Raphael Flauger, and then this paper is William McAllister, Alexander Westphal, and Gang Shou. So this is the outline. I will start with motivation, and I will try to ask the question, can we learn something about inflationary cosmology that can distinguish between different models? And I will try to focus on two observables that I think are pretty exciting, which are tensor modes and non-Gaussianity. There are many other exciting observables. I will not mention so much about those. So I will motivate why they are interesting, and then I will present a model in which these two phenomenological observables, tensor modes and non-Gaussianity, play an important role. And then I will spend half of the talk computing how this model predicts tensor modes and especially non-Gaussianity, and then I will conclude. So let's start with the motivations. So it's easy to convince people that, especially if they're working in cosmology, that we are living in the golden age of cosmology. Kobe got the Nobel Prize a few years ago. WMAP measured basically everything that you can ask about the cosmic microwave background at the percent level, or even better, for certain observables. And now we have the Planck satellite, which was launched in May 2009. And now it just finished the first full sky map on February 14th. I didn't 100% understood. What they call it a full sky map when it's 95%, because to get the last 5%, it will also take a lot of time because of the kind of non-spherical symmetric scanning strategy. So that's the idea. So we are the first. Even if it explodes now, then we already have a first full sky map, so it's good. And so the picture that is emerging for the data is compatible with lambda CDM plus, so I will focus on the early universe cosmology. Probably. Is compatible with the simplest model of inflation. So inflation was proposed to solve the horizon and flatness problem of the standard Big Bang cosmology. It doesn't really manage to solve them from first principle. It arguably alleviates this kind of problem, in the sense it might shift back the problem to the initial condition for inflation. But what surely it does is that it is a fantastic theory of cosmological perturbations, because if you write down the simplest, most naive model that comes to your mind, and you compute the perturbations, they present certain features which are in quite precise agreement with what we observe from the data. What do I mean with that? I mean that they are scale invariant, and actually the scale invariant is broken a little bit, so they are slightly red tinted. They are Gaussian, adiabatic, and small. So this is kind of the big success. And it's probably most of the people working on this, they might be more impressed by this ability of inflation to predict the right perturbation than to solve the problems which it was invoked for. And now the question is, we know that several models can achieve this. As we said, just the first model you write down basically that gives you these broad features. Can we distinguish among these models? And the other question is, have we already learned everything there is to learn about the early universe? So is it just the simplest model, which is realized in nature, or the most naive, I would argue? Or can we still see some deviation from these broad features, which would teach us a lot about our picture of the early universe? So I would like to focus on two signatures that would go beyond this naive picture that we have highlighted here. And one is tensor modes. So tensor modes, you would be able to detect them either in the temperature anisotropies or in the polarization of the CMB. And the current bound on the tensor to scalar ratio is 0.2. This is W7 map plus supernova. I didn't become so much better with WMAP 7. Of course, it was 0.22, something like that. So detection would be... interpreted within the framework of inflation would tell us what is the energy density at which inflation took place. So this is one amazing thing about the mechanism of inflation, is that the main parameter appearing in the model is the energy density, which is uncertain by, I don't know, 10 or 15's order of magnitude, and nevertheless, it gives exactly the right broad features that we observe. So this is amazing, because it's probably the only case in physics in which this happens. And this would fix this main parameter of the model, would tell when, or if you want, at which energy inflation took place. And the other kind of observable on which I would like to focus, and that I think is one of the most exciting for the near future, is non-Gaussianity. You could detect non-Gaussianity by measuring a non-vanishing three-point function of cosmological perturbations. And this would be exciting because what we said before is that the simplest model that you write down gives you Gaussian perturbations, or Gaussian to a very high accuracy. If we detect large non-Gaussianity, it means that this simplest model is not correct, and we have to review our ideas of how inflation took place. So that's why this would be particularly interesting, because it's not a large class of models, but it's a class of models that you would naively write down first to start learning something about the mechanism. This is in a way ruling out inflation, because there are, of course, models of inflation that predict large non-Gaussianities. Okay, so the rest of the talk I will focus on these two features. And, of course, there are many others. I mean, I will say something about features in the potential. For the moment, we have measured a two-point function, and we just fit it with a straight line. We might be able to find some features in this straight line. And, in fact, I will have something to say. And, of course, there are many other possible exciting things, like measuring curvature, etc. I will not have much to say about that. So apart from measuring the energy density at which inflation took place, what else do we learn from detecting tensor modes? And here I will use a theoretical argument to see which implications would the measurement of tensor modes give. And this argument is due to Life, some 12 years ago. And the idea is that if you measure, you can, in models of inflation in which epsilon is varying monotonically and slow, so it's almost constant, then you can find a lower bound on the variation of the inflaton during inflation, which is pretty strong, because if we detect tensor modes, it means R is going to be bigger than more or less 10 to the minus 2, which is, order of magnitude, the best that we will be able to do with near future experiments. So if we detect tensor modes, it means that the inflaton had to move during inflation by a distance which is larger than M Planck. So this is one important implication that I would like you to keep in mind. And the reason is that in a theory, which is, I mean, it has to be an effective field theory, because, I mean, we know that at the Planck scale, our quantum field theory should break down. So this is an effective field theory, and you're changing the BEV of the fields in your effective field theory description by a quantity which is bigger than the cutoff of the theory. So you might be worried that your effective field theory breaks down, or it might break down in a generic case. And, in fact, I will have more to say about this. And I would like to stress that this is the main motivation of the model I'm presenting. Can we have a models in which this kind of dynamics, in which you move more than the cutoff of the theory, is under control? And how would you go about studying this model? So that's the main motivation of the model that I'm presenting, which would be based on axiom monodomy. So just the punchline is this one: if we detect tensor modes, we want to investigate this possibility, it means that inflation took place at high scale, and therefore we need a large field model by the Life bound, and this leads to a strong UV sensitivity. So let me specify what do I mean with UV sensitivity. I mean the same that you might mean in particle physics. So we had this very nice workshop about effective field theories in Michigan, in which, The starting point was that you can use the effective field theory approach, which is write down all the operators compatible with the symmetry of a certain theory, and then you derive their phenomenological consequences. Then you compare these consequences with experiments, and then you put bounds on the coefficient of this effective field theory Lagrangian. And, of course, if you look at certain operators that break a symmetry, for example, you might put very strong bounds. And these operators are UV sensitive in this sense. So inflation is UV sensitive in the sense that if you start writing down the simplest model that comes to your mind, and then you you do all your calculation and you find that it works, and then follow the effective field theory prescription, write down all operators compatible with the symmetry, then you find out that whatever you said before was completely wrong or completely changed by the existence of these other operators. So especially in large field models, there is no sense in which all these operators are small if they have some natural coefficient in front of them. So this is what I mean with saying that this mechanism is UV sensitive. It really requires you to understand an infinite series of operators. So what I want to argue is that probably to analyze this kind of case, one should try to embed these models in a theory which is at ultraviolet finite, so at least in principle you are able to compute these corrections and you're able to address the question, are they there, how small are the coefficients. From the effective theory point of view, this is a problem because you're moving by a distance which is bigger than the cutoff, so masses that were integrated out, they could come inside your effective field theories, and other masses could go out. So you cannot use your effective field theory to describe it when you're moving on a distance which is bigger than the cutoff. This is why I'm going to try to address this one within a UV finite theory like string theory. So that's the main motivation for studying this in string theory. Okay, so what is the main idea? So in large field models, there are maybe two conceptually distinct problems. One problem is that you need space. You know? We said we want to have the inflaton moving on a super Planckian distance, so we need the field range of the distance to be at least bigger than Planck. And this is sometimes a problem. For example, in several models of inflation, in a class of models of inflation in string theory based on brain inflation, there is simply not enough space for the inflaton to move more than a Planck distance. So it's really a problem of space because all the scales are, you cannot scale up the volume because as you scale up the volume of the compact manifold, you also change the Planck constant. So this is basically you don't have space. And another problem is, of course, once you have space, you want also to have a flat potential to guarantee you to have 60 folding of inflation. So these are kind of two theoretically distinct difficulties that you encounter when you try to do models of large field inflation. And the model or the idea that I'm presenting today, well, first proposed by Silverstein, Bestfall, and Silverstein, Bestfall, and McAllister, is that we might try to solve both of these difficulties just with one idea, which is the idea of a shift symmetry with monodromy. So we start with an angular direction, which has something like a shift symmetry. So an angular direction is like a circle. So it has a compact field space, and it has a shift symmetry. It means that the potential is completely flat. Let me see if I can make a drawing. So we would start with this would be the field space, and the potential over the field space is just a flat potential, fine. And then we introduce a monodromy, where by monodromy I mean that we explicitly break the shift symmetry by a small term. So at the beginning, V was something like a constant because it has a shift symmetry. And then we introduce some small breaking. But let me write something which is linear, I mean, just as an example of breaking. So the idea is that as long this term does two things. First thing, it changes the field space. Now it cannot be periodic anymore. It doesn't make sense to identify this line with this because now once you go once around, you have loaded some energy inside your potential. So this identification doesn't make sense anymore. So your field space becomes non-compact. So you have transformed your angular direction into a spiral staircase. So now you have infinite space. So you can move phi as much as you want, and you can always distinguish the points. And at the same time, there is a symmetry which is potentially ensuring the flatness of the potential because when mu goes to zero, then you know you have to recover a flat potential. And therefore, if you're able to control mu and make it small enough, you can always make the potential as flat as you want. So this is the basic idea. Yes, so I'm saying, yeah, this is just an example. I mean, let's say that you could also decide to break with this one, yes, or anyone. I mean, you just choose one, and then all higher order terms would come with higher powers of the first one that you included.
Not anyone, if you take phi to the fifth, that's not good, right? Because it will contain some energy in the denominator, as you say, and there will be a strong UV sensitivity.
You could also do lambda 5 to the 5th.
Right, but then at the loop level or at the quantum correction level, you're not under control.
This is an important point. So the idea is that when you send lambda to 0, the potential has to be flat, because that's the only term that breaks the shift symmetry. So you start with something, the shift symmetry is a statement which is true to all orders in perturbation theory. So if you break the shift symmetry by some operator, all other corrections that break the shift symmetry should come with powers of lambda itself, because if you have a...
Right, let me say this way. Higher powers in phi would imply also the existence of lower powers in phi, right? But terms like phi or phi squared do not necessitate high dimensional powers.
Yes. I mean, what I wanted to stress is those lower powers should come also with the higher power of lambda.
Yes.
So in principle, if you make lambda small, you would expect those two.
Yes.
But I agree with you, yes. That's why I'm concentrating on the smallest one.
The phi case must be special as well, right? Because without gravity, it really is a symmetry, right? So some other corrections, there must be on the endpoints for us.
Which case?
If it's just phi, right? Then because you shift it, you're shifting the potential, but in the absence of gravity, you don't care about that.
Well, I mean,
phi case is additionally.
Yes, maybe this is.
Phi squared is the same.
No, the value shift the potential.
Well, that's unbounded from below, which is
yes.
A
linear term.
I'm saying it's still in the absence of gravity. If it's phi, it's still a symmetry. Phi goes to phi plus constant.
Right.
So just to phi piece.
No, but the phi itself will acquire dynamics.
Yeah.
Either from a linear term or from a quadratic term, doesn't matter.
No, of course that's true.
So then it's not even if you decouple gravity, phi is allowed at all.
Yeah. Absolutely, that's great. But I'm saying that it's more protected against quantum corrections.
I think phi is a special case in the sense that
I don't understand why is the mass term not. I mean, just right. M squared phi squared doesn't give vertices.
Because in the decoupling limit, that doesn't break.
Oh, you mean that like. Like phi squared going to some, you're imagining some vertex
with the. Yeah, just a simple thing. The phi plus a constant time gives you back to phi plus a constant in the case of phi, whereas if phi plus a constant in the mass term gives you phi plus.
But
linear term,
I see what in practical terms wrong with the mass squared.
No, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm saying that this must be more protective than a mass
squared. No, that I don't understand.
I think that there are a lot of virtues of this kind of potential, but it will not be really important for what I'm going to say if it's phi, if it's phi squared, if it is constant plus phi squared. Actually, the potential I'm going to get is going to be this, so it's not really linear, it's just linear when phi is large enough. Just the potential I'm going to derive. But maybe we can postpone, because this is really not crucial to the mechanism itself. So the idea is that whatever you break the symmetry with, you send this coefficient to zero, you recover the symmetry. In this sense, it's kind of similar to technical naturalness. So this is kind of the potential I'm going to get eventually, which is linear in a certain regime, but it's bounded from below, because it does like this. Of course, I have to write down a potential which is bounded from below if I want to do a really cosmology. So the linear case was just an approximation to large phi. Maybe it came out to be a bit confusing. So let me get to the explicit model so we can discuss that something more specific. What I wanted to stress here is that, and I will stress it more later, is that generically once you have a field which has a shift symmetry, like this one, and a natural candidate would be an axion, this shift can couple to some gauge factor, and this can induce non-perturbative corrections. So when I say that, when I have a shift symmetry, when I say that this is shift symmetric, so the potential is constant, this is true to all order in perturbation theory, but it might be broken non-perturbatively. And we will see some concrete example of this statement just in a second. So let me come to the model. I said what are the motivations is to have large field models embedded in a UV complete theory, and the idea is that we use axions. So axions in field theory, I mean, they are ubiquitous. There are many of them. They were first introduced to get rid of the strong CP problem. The main definition of an axion is a field such that that appearing in the Lagrangian in such a way that the Lagrangian is invariant when you shift the field by a constant, so it has only derivative couplings. And the continuous shift symmetry is valid as acceptable order in perturbation theory, but it's broken non-perturbatively. And therefore, it's broken non-perturbatively by coupling of the axions to, for example, some gauge sector. this is just a topological determinant, but when there are instantons in the gauge sector, this can generate a periodic potential for the axion. So typically, if you start with something which has a shift symmetry and allow, I mean, non-perturbative correction, they cannot be controlled. They are either there or not. You cannot forbid them. With the shift symmetry, it doesn't forbid them. So the typical action that we will end up with will be in canonically normalized variables, something with a canonically normalized kinetic term plus a periodic potential. And F here is the axion decay constant. In particle physics, you think of it as being the strength of the interaction of the axion with other particles. Here you can also have the equivalent interpretation that this is basically the periodicity of the non-perturbative potential. So 2 pi F is the periodicity of the non-perturbative effects. So this will be an important parameter. As I argued that the large field model is interesting to try to investigate the large field model in the context of UV finite theory, what happens in string theory, which is the story about axion, is basically the same story that we have in field theory. There are a lot of axions. For example, there are model-dependent and model-independent axions coming from various forms. For example, a p-form integrated over a p-cycle of the compact manifold would give you an axion in four dimensions. So there are many axions that arise when you do dimensional reductions or compactification of 3D. So at least the axion exists, that's the first good news. The other good news is that, in fact, they have a shift symmetry, and again, this shift symmetry is broken by non-perturbative effects. Non-perturbative effects in string theory are usually associated with the presence of a brain, or a Euclidean brain, or a Wolfshield instanton, and they have exactly the same effect. They introduce a periodic potential that can be seen as modulations on the top of an otherwise flat potential before you break it. So the string theory story is similar to the field theory story. So, I mean, the punchline is that we started with one, asking, can we do large field models of inflation? So we want the flat potentials, and therefore we invoke a shift symmetry to allow ourselves to control the flatness of the potential. And a natural candidate for something with a shift symmetry is an axion. And what I want to point out, which will be kind of the most important point about the phenomenology of this model, is that once you have axions, you typically expect non-perturbative modulations. These non-perturbative modulations, of course, like in the potential, cosine phi over f, this is some scale, and this scale, lambda, it is exponentially suppressed. I mean, it is non-perturbative in some gauge coupling. So this might be small, but in general it's there. So what I wanted to ask is that what are the phenomenological consequences of this? This will be one of the main topics of my summary. Of course, this can be small. And I'm just asking how small does it have to be such that it is compatible with what we see in the experiments. So the important is that you ask a flat potential, you get non-perturbative modulation. It's not the choice. So a cartoon of the model. So I will just have one or two slides about the actual construction of the model in string theory, and then I will spend the rest of the talk discussing the phenomenological implications. So in string theory, as we said, there are many axioms. In particular, we decide to work in type 2 orbifolds, in type 2b, sorry, string theory, in which moduli stabilization is more developed. So the axiom will be some Ramon 2 form, field integrated over a 2 cycle, which gives us a 4 dimensional action, axiom that I call C. And then if I'm wrapping a 5 brain over these 2 cycles in the compact manifold, this is inducing a monodromy. As I said, the shift symmetry is valid to order in perturbation theory, but the brain is a non-perturbative object. So if I wrap the brain on the same cycle, this can introduce the periodic potential for the axion. And you can follow this one in the dimensional reduction. And then the idea is that we want to control so this will introduce some kind of breaking of the shift symmetry. And then how do we control this breaking? How do we make it small? Because that's the crucial ingredient, is that the brain is wrapping a cycle which is in a warped region. So the stronger the warping, the smaller is the CD effect due to the brain, because the tension is redshifted. So that's how you can control it. And finally, I have to check that all the moduli stabilization procedure that makes this is compatible with the inflationary dynamics that you're postulating, which is a non-trivial task, and I mean, we studied a lot of this in the in the paper last summer, and I would not say too much about this, but it can be done. It can be made compatible. And non-perturbative corrections in this particular construction, they come from non-perturbative correction to the Taylor potential, which is not protected by supersymmetry, and they're typically related to U1 instantons, U1 Euclidean rays. So what is the potential that breaks the shift symmetry that we get from this construction? As we said, it's coming from the brain, so we can look at the action of the brain. So the action of the brain is the DBI action plus Chern-Simon term, so let me concentrate on the DBI part of the brain, of the action brain. And this is the brain, it's a 5 brain, which is wrapping a 2 cycle, and that is space-time filling. And here, this is where our axiom will come from. So this is the 6-dimensional theory. Once I compactify this one down to 4 dimensions, because I compactify the 2 cycle, so therefore I take this 2 form and I integrate it over this 2 cycle, such that I get the 4-dimensional axiom. The axiom will appear, you will get the potential for the axiom, which is something like square root of a constant, which is the volume of the cycle, plus the axiom squared. And when the axiom has a large value, this is basically a linear potential. When the value is small, then there is a minimum. So this is the picture that I was drawing before. Sample, which is basically linear here, and then this moves out. So this is the square root of 10 to the 4 plus a squared. So in this regime, it's like studying a linear inflation. So this is the potential that you get. And the idea is that if this cycle is in a warped flow, then the tension which is appearing, the tension of the 5 brain, gets redshifted by an exponential factor, which allows you to make this term small, which allows you to make the breaking of the shift symmetry arbitrarily small. Actually, you have an exponential control on how small that is.
And the Chern-Simon piece looks like the same, or?
The Chern-Simon piece looks like, If this is a D5 brain, then this is the integral of C6. B doesn't appear in the Chern. If you don't have fluxes, B doesn't appear. So this would be sum over I or C I e to the 2 pi B pi wedge. So unless you have some background flux, then this doesn't introduce a potential for me.
But in general, you do have background fluxes.
Yeah, I think that if you do have them, you have to check that those background fluxes, they... For this kind of model, let me think. I think in general you can have this effect. And this is, you can have this kind of correction to the potential, and this is something that that we studied. The idea is that, the important term is the one that is coming with C4 times D, and then you have to take the C4 from the background. So this can induce a correction, but the correction will be suppressed by the amount of the C4 flux that you have. So there you have kind of to compare the DBI part with the Chern-Simon part, and we found that they are suppressed. The main point is that there are regimes in which this one is more, because you can just make, you can scale the number of D3 brains in a different way than you scale this one, and you can make this a small correction. But this is an additional constraint on the model. I don't think I explained that very well, but I think I could explain.
Well, yeah, I think once again, we can talk a lot about this.
Yeah.
It's maybe not.
So what I want to say is that we show that there are constructions in which the term is a small corrections to the DBI term, but that requires an additional assumption, which is basically how you embed this 2 cycle in the workflow. So that's the statement. And I can make that more precise. We can discuss about the construction. Okay, so that was what I wanted to say about the string theory construction. This is basically the potential we get, and now I'm just going to study the phenomenological consequences of this model for the rest of the seminar. So if you want to know the phenomenological consequences, then we come through the perturbations that this model of inflation generates. So I will study first the background, and then study the perturbations over this background. So this is the potential that I have for inflation. You can think of it as being some slow roll model of inflation, like a linear term with superimposed oscillations coming from non-perturbative effects that you cannot choose. They might be small, and their smallness is parameterized here with B. So when B is small, these effects are small. And I want to ask the question, can we see these terms? Can we constrain them with experiments? How small do they have to be?
Sorry, why is it proportional to mu cubed? Because
and I've just redefined the parameter. I've called lambda to the 4 mu cubed b rather divided by f.
It's kind of a bit misleading because, I mean, if you think the mu goes to zero limit, the non-perturbative potential shouldn't remain.
In that sense, it's, if you take that limit, yes, but mu will be fixed by Cobin.
Right, so you say just in practice. No.
So in practice, I mean, that's not the limit we want to take. And the main reason why I use that parametrization is that the experiments, like the two-point function, of course, this will generate oscillations in the two-point function, as we will see in a second, and that puts constraints, which are bestly written in terms of B, are constraints of B. So, let me just say this other way. B is the most monotonicity parameter. So if you ask that this thing doesn't have minima, so you get stuck, then the condition is B smaller than 1. And you can see that if you are within this regime, then the WMAP data imply B much smaller than 1. So you have really to be, this thing has to be small, because we already observed the two-point function, and we don't see large oscillations on the two-point function. This, of course, depends on F. So the main parameter will be B, and we will use it to expand, so to treat this term at linear order because B has to be small. The other parameter, we started saying that we want to do large field inflation, so phi has to be much bigger than Planck. On the other hand, yes.
So I guess the CMB data implies B is small only if F is in the range where it happens to correspond roughly to the delta phi of the CMB scale.
That's correct. There is a strong dependence on F, and I will show you exclusion contours and plots in the B F plane. So you can we discuss that there. And there are generic arguments in this string theory. The axiom decay constant, so the periodicity of this field has to be much smaller than Planck. If you want, that is similar to the problem of space that I mentioned before, that if you don't introduce the monodromy, the field range is just 2 pi f, which is smaller than Planck. So you don't have space unless you introduce this monodromy. Therefore, you can think of this as having many ripples over the duration of inflation, because phi is bigger than Planck, f is smaller than Planck. So there are many ripples. And actually, there are a number which is 10 times f to the minus 1 observable in the CID. So depending on the value of f, there will be this many oscillations that we can see in the data. Okay, this is for the background. You can just solve it perturbatively in B and find the evolution of the background of the scalar field and of the metric. And what I want to point out about the background is that the slow roll parameters are not constant. They are oscillating. They are a constant part. Plus you know this oscillatory part. And the main point is that the more time derivative you take, so the higher you go in the slow roll expansion, the larger the term becomes, because you get large terms when you take time derivatives inside the cosine, because you can have a large frequency. So when the frequency comes out, so the idea is that the slow roll parameter, which has the largest number of time derivatives, would be the most important in determining the phenomenology, because they get large oscillations. So every time you see something with many derivatives, that's probably the leading term that gives us the leading effect. And what I wanted to point out is that even if they are both small, the slow roll parameters, you cannot use the slow roll formula to compute the spectrum, because they are not constant. So there is this kind of hidden assumption in slow roll that they are not just requiring that they are small, but they have to be constant. Otherwise, the solution of the Mukhanov-Sazak equation is not the right one. I will come back to this point also later. So what do we expect to see? We expect to see, this is the primordial, the spectrum of the two-point function of primordial scalar perturbation. So usually just a straight line, which is slightly rotated, and now we will have superimposed oscillation on this. So we can parameterize this thing as being, when this is zero, this is just the usual amplitude times smaller logarithmic scaling, where s minus 1 is small. But now we will have superimposed oscillations. And we want to ask what is the size of this oscillation. The frequency is simple because it's just determined by f. If you want the frequency, or said it another way, the frequency in k space is going to be cosine of phi over f, but during inflation phi is basically log k. So this is going to be cosine of log of k over f. So that's why this is really sinusoidal in log k. In log k scale. So this is what we would see in terms of perturbation. But we want to compute this analytically. This is just a guess that we made a priori. So I have just one slide about cosmological perturbation theory that I guess people are very familiar with, but let me just go through. So we have 1 degree of freedom, and I choose the gauge such that this degree of freedom is zeta, so zeta gauge, and I want to find the action for zeta around the inflationary background. And then the equation of motion from this action will give me the Mukran-Sasaki equation that I'm going to solve. And I will work in Fourier space in which the zeta k modes couple. So once I do this, I get an equation of motion for zeta k, which is the Mukran-Sasaki equation. This is a standard form. I've just written it in terms of x, where x is minus k tau, and tau is the conformal time. It just the equation looks nicer in this variable. So, and this is where the background comes in. So this is basically something, just an harmonic oscillator, but that feels a friction and force coming from the background. So usually, so if this term were not there, then the solution would be just an harmonic oscillator, something e to the I k, e to the I x, right? So this is a variable x. On the other hand, we know that the background is oscillating as well. So you might imagine that there is a resonance between the perturbation itself and the background when the two things are the same frequency. And in fact, it turns out that this is the case. And you can see that, I will show you more explicitly, that this equation has a resonance for a certain value of x. That's the value where the oscillations of the perturbations and the oscillations of the background are the same, up to a factor of 2. And basically, the solution of this equation is dominated by this resonance. So what I said before is that usually you just use a slow roll. When you use slow roll formula, you just take as a solution of this equation Hankel function 1 plus Hankel function 2, and then you impose the Bunch-Davis vacuum, so you get rid of Hankel function 2, and you're left, this is the slow roll solution. And if you write that one, it's basically e to the I x, more or less. So it's just something that oscillates. And this is a good solution until then you enter the resonance, and there is a period in which you get excited. And what you might expect is that the situation is similar to a two-state harmonic oscillator. You start in a certain state, then you go through a resonance, also the second state gets excited. So you might expect that after the resonance, also the other solution of the equation is excited with a certain coefficient c. So if you want to describe the time variation of this process, what you do is just make this T is this coefficient, time dependent, and you write down an equation for C, plugging these answers back into the equation, you find an equation for C and you solve it. And you will see that this is the equation that C gets excited once it passes through the resonance. So that's the physics, it's very clear once you understand that there is a resonance. And this is why slow roll doesn't capture this, because slow roll doesn't know that there is a resonance. So this is how I would look like in numerical. We can solve this analytically, first of all, because the equation that you obtain for C, it can be easily integrated straightforwardly, and the solution is just this one, where this is a gamma function. So if you want to, yes.
Is that exact or an approximate?
It's exact.
You got an approximate, so this is.
So this is valid at leading order in B, at linear order in B. Because I'm treating B as an expansion parameter. Okay. So this is plus order B squared. And I think this is, and of course, always for phi much bigger than Planck. I mean, this is just the regime that I'm assuming. And the axiom decay constant much smaller than Planck.
I'm just assuming I'm doing large field models and that the x decay constant is Laplacian. But provided that, that's the exact solution. You can find even an approximate solution in another expression, but this is the exact solution. So you can, this is a plot of the exact solution together with the numerical solution, that of course are indistinguishable because it's an exact solution. So just neglect the other three plots. And just look at this. Here what I'm plotting is C, so the coefficient, the amplitude of this second mode, and this amplitude oscillates around zero until you pass through a resonance, and then you get excited, and here you're leaving the horizon excited. So this kind of excitation stays imprinted inside the perturbation when they leave the horizon, so they're frozen, they come back in, and we can observe them in the CMB. So this is just to convince you that there is a... And I mean, the location of the resonance is exactly what you expected. It's a square root of f phi. So I'm always writing things where M Planck is 1. So it's something square root of f phi. Basically, the equation is e to the I x cosine of log x over f phi, the integral in the x. And then you can use stationary phase approximation. You can see this one as e to the ix plus log x divided by f phi. And this gives you a contribution just when the phase is stationary. So when the first derivative of this is 0, that gives you the solution. So what sets is basically this one, and then you do the calculation and it comes to the square root of fi is the width of the resonance. The position? Yes. So x res, the time at which you have the resonance is this one. So if you want, you can say that the earlier it takes place, this is smaller, the smaller it is. Yes. But yeah, they're basically, f is the only parameter appearing here. Phi is fixed just by the background because we are saying we are doing large field models of inflation, so phi is just 10 M Planck or something like that. And this is the solution. Okay, what you can do is that you write this one in terms of what we wrote before, so in terms of an oscillating power primordial power spectrum, and you can ask what is the amplitude. But the amplitude, we just computed it because we have C minus, and it is this formula. And then you can just expand it for small f times phi, and you get this. So, of course, it's linear in B because we are working at linear order in B. And it's scaling with this power of f times phi. So I mean, you should remind that it's scaling with a positive power of f. And this is how the primordial power spectrum look like. So this is the primordial story. So what happens once we evolve it during the history of the universe? And this is coming back to your question. Yes. It's oscillating log k because it's cosine of phi over f, but phi during inflation is just log k. That is just the amplitude. So what I'm saying is that the power. No, this is delta ns. So let me write the formula. I think that's not. The formula is amplitude of the. It is the spectral index, but you can write it in two ways. And s minus 1 times 1 plus s cosine of. This is one way to write it. And the other way to write it, which makes clear why I'm calling the spectral index, is that you take this one and bring it up to the exponent, considering that this is small. So that's why it looks as a correction to the so an s. But a k-dependent, but it's a k-dependent correction. So that's why, I mean, this is just a name that we choose for it. I think it's, for me, it's more intuitive to think of it as just the amplitude of the oscillations and not really the variation. Because once you average, delta ns is still, ns is still ns. So this doesn't change the overall ns. It just makes it oscillate once you average over the cosine. And phi k is log, okay. Okay, so we use CAM to evolve this primordial signal into the CMB and then use the WMAP likelihood code to estimate the likelihood of various parameters. So there are two parameters in the model, f, which is the frequency of oscillations, and b, which is the amplitude of oscillations. So you can show likelihood exclusion contours in the fb plane. So here, for convenience, I'm plotting b times f, because the plot, the exclusion contour looks nicer. And this is what you ask. So the white region is excluded at 2 sigma. This is excluded at 1 sigma, and this is 1 sigma compatible, the dark blue region. So the first thing to notice is that b equals 0 is compatible, so we have not detected any oscillations. We just use it to put constraint on how large can this oscillation be compatible with the two-point function. And you see that for most of the values, of the frequency, the amplitude has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 4. B times f has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 4. But of course, if this were just b, then b depends on, is b times f which is smaller than 10 to the minus 4. So b is smaller than 10 to the minus 4 divided by f. And this is what you said. As you change the frequency, you might be more or less sensitive. And we are always plotting it up to 10 to the minus 4, which roughly corresponds when you have one oscillation per bin of the CMB. Otherwise, if you have more than one oscillation, of course, you cannot be sensitive to it at all.
There's still the alias, you're still sensitive to the alias. Right? I mean, it would still be alias at lower frequencies. If you have a high frequency thing and you sample it at low frequencies, you still get a big oscillation. It just appears to be at a lower frequency. But I think you still would be sensitive at lower frequencies.
I'm not sure I understand.
I'm saying if it's oscillating faster than the distance between different L's in the CMB,
exactly,
you're not sensitive to that.
Yeah, if it's oscillating faster than between, I mean, of course this is log oscillating, so when you go to higher L's, so I'm just saying when it's oscillating faster than one bin, that one L around the first peak, then, I mean, you can stick with the analysis and you see that this thing, this doesn't make sense to it. It's very hard to estimate the likelihood of this. It's very hard not to be just putting bounds on the noise. So we just, we look at this region. Rafael also did a Markov chain here, but it just gets stuck. It's very hard to get sensible results. It becomes very spiky, the likelihood here, and it doesn't really make much physical sense because your data, you have an oscillation which is bigger than this.
Do you think the spikes in that range are real, or is that just...
I think it's basically noise, and we also try to fit noise to be sure, because, in the next, here there is a large spike, so we look at this particular solution, we seem to have a large spike, just to see how it looks like, we are convinced that this is just a noise effect, that's why we are just using it to reject the signal, to say it has to be smaller than. So this is how it looks like for one of the spikes. If you take the best value coming from one of the best value for F and S and B coming from that spike, this is how the CMB two-point function would look like. Now the oscillation are a bit small because the best value is for F pretty small. It's like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 3.5. But this is how the unbeat data look like. So, it is not unreasonable to think that there is a signal here, but for the moment we are just using the spread of this kind of data to put bounds on how large oscillations. We had some improvement of the reduced chi-square because we have had two parameters, so there is some improvement, but it's not significant. So we are just using it to reject to put bounds on f. Surely when this is bigger, it means that these oscillations are bigger than this band of the of unbeam data, so that's excluded. But I think it's interesting to look for this kind of signals because it's a very particular signal, and you wouldn't. You have to look for it to realize that there is something buried under the noise.
So the original instinctive construction is, I would have expected B of order one, the sort of natural thing.
No.
The non-pituitary effects comes from the same kind of brains that gives you from another.
No, they come from another effect. So.
But why is B different than 1?
The non-pituitary effect in string theory B is proportional to e to the minus the volume of two cycles.
Mm-hmm. You're implicitly assuming that the volume of the non-perturbative effect is bigger than the volume of the brain that you're doing.
No, no, because the brain is not exponentially suppressing the volume. So let's say the volume is a few in alpha prime unit. So let's say, because, I mean, for consistency of the complexification, the volume has to be larger in alpha prime units, so this is an exponentially small thing.
Right, right.
But the tension of the brain is just the tension of the brain. So this is naturally small, yes.
I guess the thing, I'm still wondering about this thing that I was saying before about aliasing. So, like, if I send a pure tone, pure analog tone into a speaker,
yeah,
and I play it, and then I tune the frequency. If I send in a pure tone, I first digitize it at one, you know, I sample the tone once every thousandth of a second. And then I tune the, tune the frequency of the pure tone that I'm sending in up, then I agree. So I'll hear the pure tone sweep up, and then once the tone reaches 2 kilohertz, so that, you know, or whatever, then suddenly I'm sampling at a lower frequency than the tone that I'm sending in. But I'll still hear as I sweep the frequency above that. I'll still hear, you know, as I sweep the frequency up, what I'll hear is. And then it'll go back down to a low frequency and sweeping up again, and then it'll just keep doing that. And I'll still continue to hear a pure tone. It'll just be aliased to a lower frequency than the real frequency in the speaker.
Yes, yes.
And so I'm wondering just what. So it seems like there should be a similar thing there. It seems like you should still get a nearly equally strong constraint, even for very large f.
Mm-hmm.
Just because
even
the fundamental frequency will be very high, it will look like a lower frequency oscillation.
Yes, yes. There might be, in principle, I see your point. Of course, there might be the issue that if the frequency is much lower. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that, I mean, what we did here was blindly using CAM to avoid this thing and using the live view. So we didn't put any of these words that I said, we just did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found that for frequencies which are too small, and we get something which was very irregular, which, I mean, we didn't want to show because it didn't look like a nice exclusion contour. But I think, in principle, your point is well taken. I think you're right, you have this effect. It's probably hard to make it some strong statement about the detection or rejection of it. Maybe you have to understand noise a bit better. But I think you're right. I think it, in principle, that it's there also for smaller frequencies. But it's already not good enough for this kind of range of. It's getting worse, I think. But let's discuss about it again. If you think. So, but I think you're right. The effects should be there. Okay. So what we started with was that we want tensor modes. So just to assure you that there are tensor modes, because this is large field models, so the tensor modes you just computed is 0.07, so the model lies inside the 1 sigma region of WMAP. I think this is WMAP5. So this is the first prediction that you can rule out the model if in the next 5 years Planck doesn't detect anything down to 0.05, for example, because that was the main motivation of the model. Okay, so let me come to the last part of my talk, which is about Mongolsianides. So we just started the two-point function for this model. Let me say something about the three-point function. But before coming to the calculation of the three-point function in this model with oscillation, I just make a short introduction of Mongolsianides. So the signal in the CMB look pretty Gaussian, but the best way to make this quantitative is to look at one good way is to look at odd-point correlation function. That's for a Gaussian signal to be exactly zero. So if you detect something which is non-zero, then you have the signal of a variation of Gaussianity. And in particular, the first one you might look at is the three-point function known as bispectrum. So I mean, very schematically, very roughly, you want to look at the three-point function of temperature perturbations in the sky. How do you calculate this one? So this is how you measure it experimentally. How do you calculate from first principle? Well, I mean, in the Maldacena, with his seminal paper, using the ININ formalism, said how we should compute the three-point function in interactive atom. And at leading order in perturbation theory is just the commutator of the perturbation with the interaction part of the Hamiltonian. This is the interaction part of the Hamiltonian. It looks complicated. What I would like you to focus on is that there is one term of this seven terms or six which is coming with more with more time derivative than the other. So this is coming with eta dot, while the other comes with epsilon squared. So this term has more derivatives on the background, and as we said before, this picks up more factors of the frequency, and so it becomes larger. And we compute the smaller terms, and this one is by far the larger than all of them. So it's the one that's giving us the signal.
So that one you can integrate by parts, and it's just a single term.
Yes, we thought about this integration by parts, but I think that there is the issue that there is still a boundary term.
Yeah, the boundary terms are not.
But this is time integration by parts.
Yeah, it just changes the initial conditions. You can, it's just a
yeah, I don't think that can
be noise ignore that.
What is the difference between the prime and the dot?
So this is eta dot. The difference is that when you take time derivatives, because the small parameter.
I mean, what does dot and prime mean? Prime means derivative with respect to conformal time.
Ah, yes.
And dot means
time.
What's that normal?
Yeah, I think I shouldn't have written a prime there. So I might be missing an A, or maybe this is correct, and for some strange reason I copy the formula with the dot. But sorry, it's
okay.
Up to an A, this should be a prime as well. Sorry. We thought about this integration by parts. I think I was a bit confused about it. If we take this, it is consistent to take just this Hamiltonian, and it's clear that the term coming from this one is much bigger than all the others. And then we check that once you have, I'm confused if you pick up the boundary term once you do this integration by
parts. The boundary term just, it tracks to doing some canonical transformation on the original field. There's no. No consequence of it.
I would like to look at it. We were confused about it. And, we just choose one particular way of writing the Hamiltonian and computing it.
I mean, if you think, I've written down the Hamiltonian, we normally. If you really have a spatial boundary, you need to worry about boundary terms. But when you're doing time-like boundary, you never need to worry about boundary terms, because it just corresponds to doing some redefinition of the original fields, but physically nothing changes.
But if you redefine the fields, don't you redefine the whole interaction of Hamiltonian? Okay.
That's right.
So
I'm going to just shift them around.
You just jiggle them around a little bit, so nothing really happens.
I agree, that's still the interaction of Hamiltonian, what I'm saying is that you can choose either one set of variables.
No,
with these variables, this is the term that's giving the larger. But I think.
I guess the question is: if I've written it just the zeta cubed piece, which looks very small because it's a derivative now of epsilon into 12, that's not where your effect is coming from. Is that right?
It depends, because then you redefine the variables. So I should resolve for the equation of motion of this guy. Here the zeta is the one that I solved the 5 slides ago for. So that the Mugner-Sorek equation, and I found the solution. It is not clear to me that that's the same guy that you would plug in also after you integrate by part. So with that one, then we check the time derivatives of zeta. They do not bring down the larger oscillations, because these things...
But zeta is essentially a variant of the field redefinitions, because there's only one conserved quantity at some level, so the distinction between different definitions is always down by k squared. But long wavelengths is only really one conserved quantity. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were saying in the workshop at some point. So it doesn't really matter how you define your variable, zeta will basically be the same.
But Andrew, is your worry that if there's a factor of eta double dot, the term will be smaller, or is your worry that
yeah, I mean, they...
But isn't it...
So you either...
an oscillating model of the... time derivatives and slower parameters are bigger than you.
There's two bits there. There's a boundary piece, and then there's a zeta cube piece. And I just want to know, is your effect going to come from the boundary piece? In which case, I'm worried if it's really there.
How do you mean backgrounds?
The total. Let me just split it into a total derivative.
Yes.
And the zeta cube piece. Right?
And the zeta cube, huh?
Yeah.
Without derivatives.
Without derivatives.
Ah, yes, okay.
Right, so is it coming from the total derivative piece, or is it coming from the zeta cube piece? Where is the effect coming from? Because if it's coming from the total derivative, then I worry that it's really just something.
No, I think it's coming from this. When you take this one by parts, you take the derivative there,
yeah.
And then the term becomes very large, plus the boundary term. So it would be the zeta cube term which would be large.
Okay, so then it's okay, because then it's somehow the effect that's variant of the field redefinitions.
Yes. I plan to ask you more about this, this boundary dynamic.
So it's just because you got, as you said, epsilon e to delta is not going to be small because of your oscillation.
Exactly. So when you take the derivative, it's becoming it's still large. Okay, so that, I mean, we look also at the others, and they were just small, I mean, by inspection. Because we have the solution for zeta, so we can just start. Okay, so I think I'm a bit late, so we'll go I'm using this kind of notation for the three-point function, a conventional 2 pi cube, the delta function for momentum conservation, and then I define a certain normalization for f, and I scale out the size of this thing, so I will call the size of the non-Gaussianity, this f, and then all the shape dependence, so the dependence of the three parameters, that the non-Gaussian signal depends on, is all inside this function f, so which can have different shapes. So we call this one the shape and this one the size. So in general, this depends on three things, two angles and a side, for example. So how do we... now I've shown how to compute the prime order three-point function with this informalism, as Maldacena pointed out, and how do we evolve this one into the CMB. So we decompose typically the CMB perturbations into spherical harmonics, which are independent, and then the three-point function for the coefficient of this decomposition are related to the prime order signal by this integral. So this integral is the key point, because so we are integrating over three spherical harmonics, over three radiation transfer functions. They are both very oscillating functions. So really, to perform this integral once, it requires you to take a lot of points. So you have to be very precise not to lose the effect of these oscillations. It's not an easy integral. And in addition, you have to compute this integral 10 to the 3 times 10 to the 3 times 10 to the 3 times, because this is just for one particular L, and you want to compute it for at least 1,000 or 2,000 L's. So at the end, this comes out that this is some 10 to the 19, 10 to the 20 operation to compute this one just for one model. So this is numerically extremely challenging.
It goes without saying.
So people have done some progress in looking at particular, for example, factorizable shape of the prime order non-Gaussianity. Another idea is that if we decompose all possible non-Gaussian prime order signals, all possible functions of three variables, into classes of functions that look similar to each other, then we can just pick up one representative from every class and compare it with the data. That will save us a lot of time, because we don't have to compare every function in this class, but just one representative. So to quantify, to make this thing more quantitative, we can define a scatter product between functions that tells us how similar are the functions or how different they are. So if we normalize the scatter product, we can call it a cosine. When the cosine is 1 or minus 1, it means that the two functions are parallel, so they're very similar. When the cosine is close to 0, the two functions are perpendicular, so they belong to different groups. So this is one way to, not to do too many complicated integrals, but just to do it once and try to see if there are functions that look like that. So I will come back to this point later. Okay, so what is the state of the art before we go to the calculation in this model? So the state, as I said, is very interesting. If we detect non-Gaussianity, it's very interesting to look for non-Gaussianity, because they would rule out the simplest model of inflation that you can write down. But they wouldn't rule out the idea of inflation. There are many models of inflation in which you can produce large non-Gaussianity, and they are all based on the violation of some properties of the simplest model. For example, if you get non-canonical kinetic terms like in BPI, or like in the curvature, you have extra fields, or you violate the rules, or you have sharp turns in the inflationary trajectory. All these kind of things could generate potentially large non-Gaussianity. And in particular, our model is an example of violation of the rule of, because we said the rule parameters are not constant. So of all this large class of possibilities, very few of them have been actually compared with the data. And in fact, all of them are scale-invariant non-Gaussianity. So let me see which non-Gaussianity have been compared with the data so far. So these are the three most famous type of non-Gaussianities. So as I said, they're all scale-invariant. This means that instead of being a function of three variables, they're just a function of two variables. So that's why I can plot them easily. And this is the constraint, the 2 sigma constraint coming from WMAP7 data. And the first thing to notice here is that zero is always inside of sigma, so there is no detection of Lomaxiality. And the other thing to notice is that of the infinitely many functions of three variables that we can write down, only this three has been compared. So we are really in need of a less model-dependent approach to constraining or looking for the signal. This is the state of the art. So let me quickly show you what does the computational temporal Lomaxiality in this model give us. So this would be the equivalent plot for the resonant case. So you see this is the shape that we would get that look very different from the other ones. And the fact that this can be large, I mean, this is the shape, but also the size of it is large, is because we are violating the law. I mean, the idea was pointed out by Chen, Easter, and Lim, that computed it numerically and made some educated answers for the shape of Lomaxiality. So we can compute it directly, and the computation is particularly easy once you realize that the main factor is coming from resonance. And the idea is that this is the formula for the three-point function in the in-in formalism. And then here you have the perturbations, and here you have the background. Again, like before, the perturbation behavior e to the ix, and the background oscillator is cosine of log x or sine of log x. So you just look for the stationary phase approximation of this integral. Actually, you can perform it even exactly and find the gamma function, but in a stationary phase, it's really a one-line computation, just taking the derivative of the exponential and evaluating it at the stationary point. And yeah, the main condition, well, the main physics here is that the reason why there is a resonance is that if this is 1 over half bond, then the perturbations start with a very high frequency, the frequency of order Planck, and they get stretched out until they leave the horizon when the frequency is about half bond. So if the frequency of oscillation of the background is anywhere in between Planck and Hubble, every perturbation will sooner or later resonate with the background. And that's when the large signal is produced. So a condition for the model is that omega, the oscillations of the background, has to be between Hubble and Planck. And this is actually always the case with the range of parameters we have chosen. So this is kind of when the signal is generated. Or it's generated at a different time for every k, for a fixed k at a certain time. And this is the result for the computation. So these are just basic conventional factors. This is the size of it, and this is the shape of it. So let's look at the shape. It is oscillating to a sine or cosine of log of k, where capital K is the sum of k1 plus k2 plus k3, and the frequency is basically set by f, or f times phi. And it is important that this term is also there because if you check the consistency relation, that the three-point function is equal to the two-point function squared in the squeezed limit, this term is the dominant one in that limit. So it's a good cross-check, consistency check that the computation is correct because this reproduces the consistency limit in the squeezed case. And of course it's oscillating. And then what about the size? So let me comment about, of course, if this thing were small, it wouldn't matter what the shape is. So the size is linear in B. As we said, we are working at linear order in B. And then the other important thing, so B is small in principle, but the important thing is this is coming with a negative power of F. And as we said, F is much smaller than Planck. So this is what gives a large enhancement for small frequencies. The thing that I would like you to notice is that the effect on the two-point function, they were coming as positive powers of F. If we keep B fixed, well, the effect on the three-point function are coming with negative power of F, always keeping B fixed. So it means that if you go to small or large frequency, they scale differently. So the effects, the first phenomenological consequences of this model would be different in different regions of the parameter space. So to make that graphically clear, this is again the two parameters of the model, the frequency and the amplitude in a log scale. This region is the one which is excluded by experiment on the two-point function. So this is where the two-point function cannot have this large oscillations. So two-point function tells you that you have to be below this bound, basically. And within this region, you can plot what is the size of the three-point function. These are not likelihood exclusion contours. It's just to tell you how large is the three-point function where it can be compatible with the two-point function. So this is where the three-point functions of order 1, of order 10, of order 100, and of order 1,000. So you can see that you can have very large number of scalenism, even of order 100 or 1,000, without seeing any effect in the two-point function. This is because of the different scaling. When f becomes small, the signal becomes small in the two-point function, but large in the three-point function. And this is what makes it particularly interesting. You could see the signal coming from here, small frequency, the two-point function, large frequency, the two-point function, or small frequency in the three-point function. So they're both interesting observable.
And, the shape of the non-Gaussianity is just parameterized by B and F, so in principle, if they could, it would be no more computation intensive for them to check for this.
Actually, just by F, because B just comes as an overall factor in front of you. Because it's just a sign. So it's just a sign of log K.
And no one has scanned yet for.
Right, so the problem is that to do that, to really compare it with the data, there is that extremely complicated integral to do with 10 to the 20, to compare it with the CMB, with 10 to the 20 computation to do. So you can simplify that one if you have a shape which is factorizable. So I need someone to start thinking about factorizable templates for Gibson. Which is, I don't know, I mean, we didn't think about this for more than a few hours, but it doesn't look good to have a good factorizable template. And the other thing that you might try to do, but I think this is an important problem, to really look for this kind of signal in the CMB. This has not been done yet. We have some ideas of how to perform that integral that I showed you before analytically using stationary phase again, because there are a lot of oscillations. So you might do some progress analytically and then have a less challenging numerical work to do. But the other thing that one could try to do, I mean, this would be the ideal thing to do, of course. But before one does that, what we try to do is, well, some people already put constraints on certain shapes, so why don't we compare it with those shapes and see if we can import those constraints? It's the idea of using the cosine that I mentioned before. If our shape looks like the other shape, maybe we are already constrained by the data. And the result of that analysis is the following. This is the computation of the cosine of resonant non-Gaussianity times local, equilateral, and orthogonal shapes. And notice that here the plot is between 0.1 and 0.1. So if you plot it in really minus 1, 1, the cosine, you see that the cosine is basically 0 for every shape. So our shape is very orthogonal to all other known shapes which have been constrained by the data. So the constraint from the data on those shapes are basically irrelevant, are very weak on our shape. And the intuition is that there is less than 10% similarity between these two shapes. The intuition is that our signal is oscillating, while all the signals which have been compared with the data are simply smooth. So when you do the scatter product of this thing, you get only zero, because it averages zero.
Sorry, which side is the equilateral?
So this is, for example, the equilateral one. And this is the resonant non-Gaussianity.
That corner and your...
This is the corner in which it is 1, 1, I think. Yes, so that's the equilateral one. The one here. Okay, this one, of course, this is a function of three parameters because it's not scale invariant. Here I'm plotting just two. If you were to plot the third parameter as, for example, time, you would see the phase moving, right? Just the wave moving. So the phase of that thing is not fixed, just a shape. Okay, let me come to my summary, sorry to be a bit late. So this is schematically the conclusion. So we started with observation and argued that there are interesting possible observables like tensor modes and non-Gaussianities that could be exciting in the near future. Then following from the idea of having tensor modes, which ask for high-scale models of inflation with large field, we argued that we need flat potential just to get 60-folding, and there are strong theoretical reasons that tells that if you want flat potentials, you should invoke a symmetry to ensure the flatness, otherwise quantum correction would exploit the flatness of the potential you started with. That's why a natural candidate for an inflaton is an axiom which has a shift symmetry. But as I argue, when you have a shift symmetry, you typically expect that this is a good symmetry to order in perturbation theory, but it might be broken non-perturbatively. And the typical effect of non-perturbative corrections are modulations on the top of your potential. And what we studied here are the phenomenological consequences of modulations. which as we have seen are both modulations of the two-point function and also the larger three-point function, which nicely takes us back to observation. So thank you all for listening.
We're a little over time. Any quick questions? Also, any cosmic year until
Friday. Mm-hmm. Right. So, it's more following up from a discussion. So, I think I now understand how this fits in the effective field theory framework, because you're getting it from a zeta cube piece, which in that language would just be a pi cube piece. And then you get that from the potential. And normally, what they're doing is they assume that the derivative pieces are dominating of the physical potential.
Exactly.
But you could expand out. You could still do the decoupling where you ignore gravity. You assume you're above the mixing scale, but expand out to the potential pieces to the pi cube piece as well, and you should be able to see your effect even within that framework.
Okay, that would be very interesting if we could look at. But do you think that would, I mean, that would make a simplification of what we did now? So what we did now is
It's now in a general any inflation model. You've got this pi cube piece there, and you could get the same type. Again, if your background has any oscillating contribution, you could get the same kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah, maybe you should. Yeah, I want to ask you about that. I think that's interesting. I mean, naively, the reason why they didn't see it so far is because they went really to the zero limit. And this thing violates zero.
Yeah, it's not just that. It's also they just drop those pieces explicitly. Any non-derivative suppressed pieces. And you do have non-derivative.
And I thought the reason why they dropped it is that because in this zero, the strict zero limit, in which all zero parameters are small and constant, then that is just small. Okay, this is probably, yeah. I think it's equivalent to what you're saying.
Yeah.
In the sense that the three-point interaction coming from the potential are small if you're reading the zero limit. Yeah. Where like all the zero parameters are small.
But I guess what it shows you is you can still do the ignore the coupling to gravity, and you're still above the mixing scale.
Yes.
So you still just got the Goldstone degree of freedom capturing everything, but now you've got some things that were subleading before now being redundant.
Yeah,
no,
that's interesting.
That was not a quick question.
Sorry.
So I'm just for another question. So you just took the most simplest periodic potential as a function of your, on top of your linear potential, saying that these are not the derivative. So, recent years there was a discussion of how the, say, QCD vacuum energy depends on theta, and there were various arguments why potential is not just a sinusoidal, but a combination of. So there are many different branches of combinations of different sinusoidals, and your actual potential is tracing some, the lowest branches, so that it has some cusps and so on. And are there any? So I presume the same thing can happen. Can happen in the string theory. I mean, if you're creative enough, you can create non-determinative potentials that are not just a simple sinusoidal, but some potential with cusps and so on. So this is important parts of the sinusoidals, right?
So this would be a sum of sinusoidal?
If the sum is trivially, merging into your formulas, right? It will be like the actual potential. Imagine there would be two shifted sinusoidals, right? But the potential would trace the kind of the intersecting parts, the lowest parts. That's I'm not an expert in this, but there's been a lot of discussion on this, right? What is the theta dependence of QCD and how it there are some multivariable functions and how you should choose the potential and so on. In that case, you might have some cusps in your potential.
Actually, maybe related to that. So if these are contributions are suppressed by e to the minus 1 over g squared, so you want g to be pretty big to have them be significant.
Yes.
And then you expect like higher order in that same regime, I guess there would, well, there's some competition, but if g gets too big, then you expect a sum of the first order instant time plus higher order instant time.
Well, I mean, as I show, we can be sensitive to b when this is of order 10 to the minus 4 divided by alpha. So we can be sensitive to b, which is 10 to the minus 2 or so, in which case the expansion is really good expansion. When you are really required that b is of order 1, yes. But for example, you could, in the plot that I showed you, in which I was showing b and f, and here was 1, and here was 10 to the minus 4, if you don't like this region, you can cut away this region, and always keep the b to be smaller than 0. And then you would be safe neglecting higher. I mean, that's even required, because we are doing anyway an expansion in B. So I would say that higher instantons would have a similar effect as higher order B that we neglect. So yeah, I have to be in the case in which... So B is kind of lambda, which is kind of e to the minus 1 over g squared. So this is what sets the size. I agree with you that when the size is of order 1, it's not consistent with the reason. I have to restrict to that.
Is that really g-string?
No, this is g and this.
Okay.
What I mean, otherwise it would be g-string to just one power. So in the string theory case, this is a string theory. In the string theory case, this thing would be e to the minus the volume of some two cycles, which is a two-cycle wrap, for example, by an ED1 instanton or a Warshit instanton. And I think here you get some power of g-string that I don't remember. I think it's something like 2 power, something like this.
I missed something. Did your solution smoothly go to bunch theories on larger scales on bipolar?
Yes. Because before the resonance, takes place, basically you are reading bunch theories. And then it happens that when you are at frequency higher than the frequency of the background, you don't even know that the background is oscillating. And this is equivalent of exciting bunch Davis out of the bunch Davis vacuum when you start resonating with the background. So from here on, you could say, well, from here on, it's like I started from non-bunch Davis. But, I mean, it's really nice to, instead of postulating this, to see how this comes about. And it's not just, you know, in a particular state out of bunch Davis, not anywhere. Yeah, that's a good point.
So you're doing, the way you do logical, it's special. There's special about the linear thing, right? Because otherwise you'd have had the eta problem back if you'd chosen anything.
No. I mean, the idea is that even if you do, I mean, actually we're not doing things in linear, no, in the sense that this has some linear terms.
Yeah, but you're at the large value of phi, so it's still roughly linear.
But I'm saying that even if you had, what is our discussion? Even if you had m squared, phi squared, the idea is that as long as you make this more, higher correction should come with power of this. So that's, I mean, the argument. Yeah, the punchline from the effective field theory point of view, at least, is that really when you break the shift symmetry with a term, then higher correction comes with higher powers of that term because you need to use that curve next. So the idea, if you can make that small, those are small.
So M is still much smaller than H.
M should be, yes. I mean, the idea is that you are able to control this one, for example, is the leading term with which you break it. And then you get higher order correction, which is like 5 to the 4, that in principle would spoil you, but now they're obliged to come with powers of m divided by some cutoff.
Yeah.
And that's how you, if you make m small, those should be small as well. So that is the idea. So it doesn't rely on the fact that it is linear. That is the idea.
I'm missing something then, because suppose, forget the axiom, suppose I just had m squared, phi squared.
Yes.
I can say the same logic that if that term is not there, then I have a shift symmetry.
And I think, I think in principle, I mean, this is what Linda and someone else said. If you just write, if it's really only m squared, phi squared, then it is relatively stable. And even coming with gravity, it doesn't find that, if it is only there. But then, my point is that. You cannot ask this question in effective field theories, which is, or you can't say that that is the whole theory, no?
But I'm saying that if you should ask it in fundamental theory, which might have other coupling, and here I'm trying to check whether this other coupling arises, and whether you. But I think that if you were to say Cauchy invision is everything existent, and it's just f squared pi squared, that's relatively stable. I think that would be true.
It's true, but you don't believe it.
I don't believe it.
No, because phi is bigger than pi squared, right? I mean, technically, if that was it, you would be ready to be stable.
Yes, but I know that's not it.
But that's not the truth.
And that's an effective
theory. Yes, let's just say there's a shift symmetry, and then it's exactly this moment.
No, but that is still an effective field theory, so I would like to use this idea from the effective field theory, but in a theory in which I can ask it.
I write an effective field theory for phi, and then I just say, I write all the operators with all the symmetries, but when you write an effective field theory, you have to decide which symmetry you have to start with. So if you impose a shift symmetry, then that tells you which graph phi squared is technically natural, if you have it.
Yeah, but I guess we're saying any chaotic inflation model writing for potential goes to zero with a shift symmetry then. So why can't I always use that argument?
Well, they always were. That's the only way they were ever justified. But then you say, why? Where is the symmetry coming from?
I'm not sure they were justified.
They were relatively stable, but they were the relative stability. My point was that analyzing something in the effective field theory is not enough, because you might have that the effective field theory breaks down because you're moving by a distance which is bigger than the cutoff. So, for example, even if you're saying that in your effective field theory there is a shift symmetry, then you notice this shift symmetry might be broken at energy scale higher than the cutoff of the theory, right? The effective field theory doesn't tell you that. And what I'm saying is that if the shift symmetry were broken, even at the Planck scale, which is higher than the cutoff of the theory, we might still get Planck surplus operators that are still enough to spoil it. So that's why I want to address, to ask about the shift symmetry in a theory in which I can compute when the shift symmetry is broken, by which effect, and how large is the breaking coming from this effect. So I think that the catch in the Cauchy model is that that's an effective field theory, which is relatively stable as long as you say this is the only thing I have. But effective theory is not enough to ask about theories which move more than Curly cutoff.
It's a bit weird because if I do effective field theory, usually I can say that I can assume symmetries are valid above the cutoff of the effective field theory, because otherwise then I really should write every single operators.
Yes. But the meaning of that when you do particle theory is that as long as you do experiment at energies below the cutoff, that's okay. But the problem of inflation is that it's much more UV sensitive than most things we know, in the sense that even if you have operators which are suppressed by the cutoff, they can still change the physics. Well, if you do scatterings, then you have...
If I take a Carroll perturbation theory, don't I assume that baryon symmetry is a symmetry above... all the way to the Planck scale, so that I can use baryon symmetry to constrain my effective field theory, even the irrelevant operator?
No, but I think that there you can say, well, baryon symmetry is broken at a certain scale, lambda, and you would see that the effect are still small. I mean, they would depend, the size would depend by lambda, the scale at which baryon symmetry is broken, but the effect would be still small, as long as it is broken at a higher scale than the cutoff of the theory.
Okay.
What I say is that for inflation, that's not the case. Those effects are never small perturbation to your dynamics.
Let's have lunch. Okay, let's go.